Leff from Israel. Rabbi Leff has been here a number of times, and each time he's spoken, I think last time Rabbi Leff spoke about prayer, the time before that I think it was current events through the eyes of the rabbis. And this lecture I'm sure will also be incredibly inspiring. We're speaking on ghosts and reincarnation. Enjoy it, Rabbi Leff.
Okay. I'll tell you the truth. When I first got this topic as the topic that was requested for me to speak about, I was pretty much going to refuse. I'll tell you the reason why. It's more important for us to worry about our own souls rather than other souls that are wandering around. And instead of worrying about reincarnation, I have enough trouble worrying about this time around, let alone the next time around. So really, what is proper for a Torah Jew is to worry about his own soul and to worry about this world and to do it right. And then I saw that the Stipler, the Yisrael Yaakov Kanievsky, Zecher Tzadik Livrocha, one of the great giants of Torah of the past generation, encouraged people to write books about ghost stories. And I'm going to quote some of them. I'm not a great storyteller, but part of this will be some of the occurrences that bring out these ideas. Because he said people today believe in the physical world, the material world. They're so steeped in it that they don't realize that there's a spiritual world altogether. And anything that can strengthen a person's belief in the spiritual world is a positive thing. So if that's how he felt, so I really had no right to refuse the topic, so I'm going to speak about it. And I'm not even going to try to evade it. I'm going to speak about it exactly as it implies. And I think that this concept is brought out by the Malbim. The rabbis say that the details of how Mashiach is going to come are things that no one can know until it happens. And therefore, there's no purpose in speaking about all these details and making it a major topic. When it happens, you'll know what it is. And surely to calculate when the time for Mashiach is ripe is also not a proper thing. The Malbim lived about 150 years ago. He calculated a time when Mashiach should have come. It's past already, in one of his books. And he was asked, isn't he aware of the fact that the rabbi said that one should not do that? So why did he do it? And he gave the following answer. He gave a story. He said there was once a man who set out on a cross-country trip across Europe. And he was going by wagon and horse and wagon that was going to take months. And he had his little son with him. And about a half an hour outside of the city, the son turns to the father and says, when are we going to get there already? You ever took a trip with your children? You know that's what happened. So the father slapped the child in the face and he said, I don't want to hear that question again. 6 months go by and the father taps the wagon driver on the shoulder and he says, when are we going to get there already? The son looks at the father and he says, you hypocrite. When I asked that question, you slapped me in the face. And now you're asking the same question. The father said, look, you asked me the question a half an hour out of our city. If you were so impatient and I would tell you it's 6 months more to go, you would have given up hope. Now we're almost there. Now's the time to ask the question. So too said the Malbim. The time of the rabbis, Mashiach, was so far off that if they would have given a date so far in the future, people would have given up hope. But now, it's almost here. Now's the time to ask the question. It's a beautiful story, but you don't refute the words of the sages with a nice story. basically what the Malbim is telling us is the following. Certain things are prohibited because they have no purpose to them. Just the opposite. They would serve a negative purpose. But in a time when those same things will serve a positive purpose, for instance, when it's just a matter of discussing the details of when Mashiach, how he's going to come, when he's going to come, and it serves no positive reinforcement, then it's prohibited. But if the generation needs that, and that's what makes people believe more that it's going to happen, and they're excited, and they're discussing it, or whatever, then there is a purpose to it. Then it's permissible. So I would say the same thing with our topic. To talk about ghosts and reincarnation just in an abstract, theoretical a way that has no bearing on our own belief and our own life, maybe entertaining, but I didn't come here as an entertainer. There are many entertainers that you could hire who will make you a much happier time than me. But if I see that this topic is something that people are interested in, because it'll strengthen their belief in a spiritual world, and Taka make it that maybe they will intensify their own spiritual lives, then there's a purpose in discussing it. And I hope to discuss it from that perspective as much as possible. So let's start with a discussion of souls. Most of us think that we are bodies. That's who we are. And we happen to have a little Casper, the friendly ghost, flitting inside of us called a soul. That is not the way it is at all. We are souls. We were created as souls many thousands of years ago, way back at the beginning of creation. And we have been, all of us, in a spiritual world. We've forgotten it. And there's a good reason why we've forgotten it. But we all were in a spiritual world as souls and functioned very nicely without a body. We could see without eyes and hear without ears and get around without arms and legs and think without a brain. Because the soul in a spiritual world is functional. When we come into the physical world, then we need a suit of clothing that's called a body to be able to function in a physical world. I always like to compare it to an astronaut. When an astronaut is on terra firma, he's here in this earth, he doesn't need any special apparatus to function. He can breathe the oxygen in the atmosphere, there's air pressure, there's sound waves, he can communicate very nicely. But when he goes into outer space, so he needs a space suit to be able to function. He needs air pressure, because there is no air pressure in outer space. He needs oxygen to breathe. He needs an oxygen apparatus because there is no oxygen in outer space. And he needs a radio with which to communicate because there are no sound waves. So he needs to communicate by radio waves. When he comes back to Earth, takes off the suit, doesn't need it anymore. He can function again very nicely back on Earth without the suit. Similarly, as long as we were in a spiritual world, we could function, which is our souls, which is us, could function very nicely without any physical apparatus. When we come into the physical world, we need a physical body to be able to function in a physical world. When we go back to the spiritual world, then we shed that body, leave it here, and go back as spiritual beings, again, who can function very nicely. And I think that's one of the ideas behind the concept of manifesting mourning for someone who's died by tearing our clothing. That's one of the manifestations, one of the laws of what a person has to do when he is mourning, tear his clothing. Because it shows it's only the clothing that's been torn away. But the essence of the person still exists. The person hasn't changed. The person has just changed his venue from a physical world to a spiritual world. So it's the clothing that's been torn away, but not the essence of the person. The soul is made up of five different parts, and they are not separate parts. They're all aspects of the same united soul. The soul has a nefesh, and that is the part that connects to the physical body. That is on one side, the connector to the physical body, and I'll discuss what these are in a second. Then the soul has a ruach, a spirit, and then it has a neshama, which is a higher spiritual entity, and then there's something even beyond that, and that is the yechida, the individuality of the soul, and chaya, and the life force of the soul. Now, in a nutshell, without going into too much detail, those parts are the following. The nefesh is the appetite of a person, all of the animalistic appetites that we share with the animal kingdom. Appetite for food and for procreation and all the other animalistic drives that a person has, those are contained in the lowest part of the nefesh, which connects to the body, which is a physical entity. And these are physical drives. The other side, the nefesh, as all the other parts, have many, many subparts to them. In fact, each one has 10 subparts to it. The lowest one connected to the body, and the highest connected to the next level of the soul, which is the ruach. The ruach is more the spirit. That's more the emotional side of a human being. The emotions come from that part of the soul. And then there's neshama, which is related more to the intellect of a person. And finally, the intellect on its highest point, that part of the neshama, is connected to what's called the yechida. Yechida is the soul that is separate from the body and that can experience the total spiritual pleasures that exist in the world, not in this world, but in the spiritual world. And chaya is the soul as it attaches itself to God. So we have like a chain. We have one end of the soul attached to God, and the other end all the way down, the fifth level down, attached on the other end to the body. Portions of the soul are actually contained within the body, everything up to the neshama. The other two are not necessarily inside the body. Person is connected when he's in this world to those two levels that are in a spiritual world still, yet he's connected to those two parts of his soul, the yechida and the chaya. They exist in spiritual worlds. They are not part of this physical world, yet the person is connected into those parts of his soul that are in the spiritual world. So that's the makeup of the soul itself. Now, the soul, like we said, when a person comes into this world, gets a suit of clothing. And it's interesting, the body patterns itself after the soul. The best way of understanding that, I think, is the following. Well, you can have something in one mode that is an energy, and in a different mode, it takes on a picture, a sound. Take a videotape. On the videotape, there are electromagnetic impulses. You can't see them. They're energy. But when you pass them over the head of a video player, it turns that electromagnetic energy into light and into sound. And now you can see an image and you can hear a sound. What's on the tape is exactly the same thing as the image, only in a different mode. If you alter the electromagnetic impulses, you will alter the image on the screen. You'll alter the audio, right, on the soundtrack. So they really don't look at all like each other. They're in different modes, but they're the same thing. Therefore, when the soul comes into a physical world, it takes on a physical form, and the body molds itself after the makeup of the soul. That doesn't mean that souls spiritually look like bodies. But in the physical world, what the soul is composed of, in a spiritual sense, is reflected physically through the body. So the soul also has arms and legs and eyes, not as we see them here, but this is the physical manifestation of those spiritual concepts. That's how it works out. So there's a very close connection between the body and the soul. And therefore, even when the soul is no longer connected to the body, it also has a spiritual form to it. And even though the soul is a spiritual entity, when it is still amongst the physical world, but not in its physical form, it is seen in what appears to be a physical form. So if you have a soul that people see in this world, and we'll see how that's possible, they see it as clothed, as in a body, but it's not a real body. It's more of a spiritual entity that patterns itself after the body than being a physical body itself. There are times in life when the soul is looser, more loosely connected to the body than under normal circumstances. One of those times of life is before birth. The soul already occupies the body at conception. So say the rabbis. Soon as conception takes place, the soul enters that body in formation. But it's not connected in a very tight way to the body. The soul is still hovering between the spiritual world and the physical world before a person's born. And therefore the rabbis tell us that an embryo can see from one end of the world to the other. The constraints of the soul in the body, which constrain it to time and place, don't exist before birth. And therefore we know that an embryo learns the entire Torah with an angel. This is all done on a spiritual level. And before a person is born and his soul becomes connected to the body in a very strong way, he forgets all of this. An angel comes and hits him on the mouth, and he forgets everything. The Maharal Prague asks a very simple question. If you want somebody to forget something, you don't hit him in the mouth. Hit him in the head, right? You have to give him a concussion to make him forget. Hitting him in the mouth may hurt his teeth, but it's not going to make him forget things. Why does it hit him in the mouth? The answer is the mouth represents the barrier between the inner spiritual and the external physical. In fact, speech is what takes that which is most spiritual and combines it with sound waves or whatever and makes it into something physical in this world. That is the barrier, the mouth. What happens is when the soul becomes intricately woven into the body, then the spiritual aspect of the soul is forgotten in the memory of the body and the brain or whatever. And a person has to forget all of that. Because if we remember everything that happened before we were born, if we remember where our souls were before we were conceived, then we'd have no free choice. We would remember godliness and remember what the souls were, and we'd have to live in this world as robots. And God wants us to choose to believe in the spiritual, not to be forced. So all of that is forgotten, and then it depends on our free will. It's not something that we are forced because of our memory. But every once in a while, sometimes people get a glimpse, a flashback of what was. And we'll see when that happens in a second. So that's one time in life where the soul is not yet woven intricately with the body, and it's more on its own, and it's more aware of the spiritual world. That stops at birth. There's other times, though. And the major time that I want to speak about is when a person is asleep. At sleep, the body and the soul, to a certain degree, separate. Not totally, because that's called death. But the rabbis say that sleep is 1/60th of death. Now, that doesn't mean if you have 60 people sleeping in a room, a Kohen can't go in. Right? Or if you sleep 60 times, you're gone. Right. What does it mean? You're all familiar with the concept in kashrus of 1/60th. If you have something non-kosher fall into a kosher mixture, and there's 60 times of the kosher mixture as of the non-kosher, then oversimplifying things, under certain circumstances, the whole mixture becomes permitted. Because when there's 60 times or more, the thing loses its identity. something maintains its identity up to 60 times in a mixture, 60 times more than itself. But anything less than 60 times, it still maintains its identity. So there is the smallest connection. There's still an identity of death in sleep, but it's the smallest connection. It's 1/60th, that it still maintains the concept. Death is the total separation of the soul and the body. Sleep is a partial separation. That's one of the reasons why we wash our hands in the morning. Because a person, a dead person, is tame, is spiritually defiled, defiles others. Because the idea of spiritual defilement is wherever there was a manifestation of holiness, of spirituality, and it left, the vacuum that is left is called spiritual defilement. So when the greater the spirituality, the greater the defilement. A Jewish dead body is much more serious as a source of defilement than a non-Jewish dead body. And a non-Jewish dead body even more than an animal. Because the level of holiness and of spirituality, where it's greater, the vacuum that's caused when it leaves is greater too. So when a person sleeps, to a certain degree, his soul leaves him insofar that he's not active. He's not productive. And therefore, to a certain degree, his spiritual productivity stops for a while, temporarily. Where is productivity represented? In the fingers of the hands. This is where a person's productive. So where does that spiritual impurity remain after a person gets up from a sleep? On his hands. That's why I have to wash your hands in the morning. And that's the concept of sleep being 1/60th of death. Now, since the soul is more loosely connected to the body when a person sleeps, it's more aware of the spiritual world. And this is one of the sources of dreams. It's not the only source. There are three basic sources of dreams. The major source of dreams is, as Freud said, except he didn't discover it till thousands of years after the rabbis already said it, is what a person's thinking about, what's on his mind. At night, your imagination, right, brings up what's on your mind during the daytime. Your subconscious mind brings up what your conscious mind was involved in. And that's majority of dreams, and therefore they're really insignificant except to tell you a little bit about what's on your mind, what you're thinking about. There's another kind of dream, that's the other extreme. Those are prophetic dreams. God chooses to communicate with people sometimes through dreams. The prophets sometimes were communicated through, it's the lowest level of prophecy. Pharaoh was shown a dream that was a prophetic dream. Those dreams are communicated by angels, by God himself, to prophets, and those are prophetic dreams. Those are not the run-of-the-mill dream either. They are very, very rare, and in our time, they don't exist. Then there's the middle level, which is the one we were going to talk about. That is where a person's soul is, to a certain degree, free of his body, and therefore is aware of what's going on in the spiritual world. Now, everything that happens in the physical world originates in forces in the spiritual world. Let me give you an example to what that is physically. How do the weatherman know that in 3 days it's going to rain? Right? He does not a prophet. Because he sees the various factors in nature, right, weather factors that are taking place now. He sees there are low or high pressure systems, there are winds, and at what direction they're going and how fast they're going. There are clouds, and if you put all of it together, right, then you know that according to the wind speed and direction and where there are high and low pressure areas, right, and where there's evaporation and clouds are forming, within 3 days those clouds will have absorbed enough moisture and the pressure system will be proper for the cloud to give up its moisture in X place, because you can extrapolate that based on the speed of the wind and the direction of the wind and the various other factors, that's going to mean that it's going to rain 3 days. So he sees the forces in place, and he extrapolates what that means for the future. There's a Talmud Gemara that says the following: there is no blade of grass in this world that doesn't have an angel standing over it saying, "Grow." Now, you can understand that if you want, literally, that there's these little flitting winged things screaming "grow" on every blade of grass that we don't hear, and that's acceptable, but that's not what it means. Angels are spiritual forces. When you take a seed and you put it in the ground, there is something, some kind of physical force that tells that seed that it's no longer in the packet and it's in the ground, the moisture, whatever it may be, that sends a message to the cell to begin to propagate and to grow. That's a physical force. We believe that there's a spiritual world, and therefore, before those physical forces are set into motion, there are spiritual forces set into motion. And one force sets another one until those spiritual forces set those physical forces into motion, and then they have a chain reaction until the result occurs. So if you could be privy to the spiritual forces that are set into motion in the heavens, and you would know what those spiritual forces represent as what they are causative of, then you could extrapolate what probably is going to happen in a few days based on what forces are in progress. Give an example. Imagine if you had this very long machine with a lot of gears, and the machine has two buttons, the red button and the green button. If you push the red button, you set a bunch of gears into motion that eventually deposit a bag of potato chips, or you call them crisps, right, on the other end of the machine. You push the green button, sets another set of gears into motion that eventually will deposit a bag of pretzels on the other side of the machine. And this takes a week. It's a long, long machine. Okay. If you know how the machine works, and you see somebody pushing the red button, now the red button doesn't look like crisps. It has no connection at all to crisps. But you know that that force has set into motion a bunch of gears that eventually will deposit a bag of crisps on the other side of the machine. If you see them push the green button, green buttons have nothing to do with pretzels. They don't look like pretzels. A green button, but you know that that has set into motion the forces that eventually will deposit that bag of pretzels on the other side. It's clear that even though that's probably what will happen, it's possible it won't. Maybe a technician will come and stop the machine in the middle, or change the direction of the gears, or cross them. It's always possible that a technician can override what's been set into motion. But barring any special technician, what's going to happen most probably is that if you set those powers into motion, this is what's going to happen. And therefore, since there are powers that are set into motion in the heavens, and those powers don't necessarily look like the result, just like the green button doesn't look like crisps or the red button like pretzels. So if you see in a dream things that are basically symbolic in a spiritual sense, your soul saw these things in the spiritual world in motion, it communicates it back to your brain, and your brain sees it as a symbol. That symbol represents some force that's going to cause some kind of result. And therefore, that's the idea of interpreting dreams. The people who are aware of what those symbols are, they know what the red button represents and what the green button represents, even though it has no logical connection to the thing that is being interpreted. but that's how it works. These are spiritual forces which your soul is aware of. It communicates back to your brain. You see it as symbols in a dream, and those symbols can be interpreted. Sometimes what you see is what your soul sends back as the result, and then sometimes you see the future. Has anybody ever had a dream of something? Usually it's very close by. It's not something way in the future. It's things that were powers were already set into motion, and you saw what's going to be the next day, the next 2 days, or whatever. You saw in a dream something that actually happened 2-3 days later. That's not uncommon. It's a very common thing, and this is the way it works. Because your soul is aware of various powers that have been set aside in the heavens, and again, it's not foolproof. Because there's a technician called God, and he can change the order of these forces if he chooses. So you have to factor God into the equation and realize that all these things are possibilities and potentials, but they're not necessarily ironclad, because there's a technician who can change things. So that is how dreams happen. Sometimes also your soul, the portions of your soul that are in the spiritual world all the time, and you're just connected into them. It's like this wireless connection. Right? It's not in the chassis of the thing. It's outside, but it's connected in. Sometimes your soul sees things even when you're awake in the spiritual world and communicates back to you, to your subconscious, some danger that's lurking in the future. And sometimes you become apprehensive about things. You have no idea why. But it's because your spiritual part of the soul has seen things that you're not aware of, has communicated it back to your subconscious, and you're aware of something that you should be apprehensive of, even though you're not sure exactly what it is. That's also a way for a person to his soul to be aware of things separated from the body to a certain degree, even when a person's alive. Okay. Which brings us to the next point. Death. Person dies, so his soul and his physical body separate. Now, they don't separate totally. Almost totally. Even from a scientific standpoint, a person's nails continue to grow after he's dead, his hair continues to grow, the cells continue to multiply in many areas of the body, certain parts of the body deteriorate faster, the brain cells or whatever, and other parts of the body continue growing, and the cells don't die for a long time. There is always a portion of a person's nephesh, that appetitive part of the person, that drive part, that remains by the bones of a person who's died, certain life force. And that life force can be manipulated by people who are necromancers and diviners or whatever, these kinds of seances or whatever. Most of them are a bunch of bunk. But the concept does exist. It's prohibited for a Jew under most circumstances to be involved in this. That doesn't mean that it's not legitimate. It's just prohibited. Just as pork exists, in case you didn't know. The Torah prohibits eating it, not because it doesn't exist, but because it does exist, you're not allowed to eat it. The Torah prohibits various kinds of astrology and magic. I see Rabbi Tatz is going to speak about that sometime in the future. I've divined that up. No, saw it in a poster on the outside. These things do exist, but they are for the most part prohibited to a Jew because of the technician. Because we should not run our lives on potentials of forces of nature or spiritual nature, because we have a connection with God who supersedes all of that. And we should have trust in God rather than trust in all these other spiritual forces. But in any case, These things are the basis, that life force that's by the dead body. It's not the soul that's in the spiritual world. It's the life force that remains by the body, can be manipulated to be able to have some kind of connection and communication with that person with the lowest level of his soul, which is still connected somewhat to the body. Why I said that most of it today is bunk, I'll give you another example. Imagine a primitive native who comes over from the deepest Africa, very intelligent and enterprising young man, and he comes to a home here in England and he sees a miracle. You turn a switch on the wall and lights go on. They don't burn the ceiling, right? They are not fire that's going to burn anything, and you have light. So he says, I'm going to become a millionaire. So he buys up light bulbs and sockets and switch plates and switches, and he goes to deepest Africa and he calls his whole village and he says, I'm going to show you a miracle and I'm going to sell it to you for a nice price. So he nails his switch plate to the wall and the switch, and he makes a hole in the top of his hut and he screws the light bulb into the roof. And he says, now watch this. And he flips the switch, and nothing happens. He says, they cheated me. They thought I'm a primitive person, and they sold me defective things. So he runs back to England with his switch plate and his switch and his light, and he said, you sold me defective things. So they don't work. I flipped the switch, the light didn't go on. He said, did you check your fuses? What fuses? Did you check the wiring? What wiring? All he sees is the bulb and the switch plate. But there's so much behind the scenes that if you don't know what that is and how to connect it properly, it's meaningless. Today, we have, to a certain degree, a vestige of all these things that they know the externals. But all the wiring and all the things behind the scenes have been forgotten. So many people attempt to go through the motions of all these kinds of magic and whatever it may be, when in fact all they know is the externals and they have no idea what's behind it, and therefore it's useless. And sometimes not only useless, but it's dangerous if you don't know what you're doing. If you don't know how to make the wiring proper, you know there's something to do with wiring, you can make a short circuit and burn your whole house down. So it's even more dangerous than just useless. In any case, so it's possible for a soul, usually, let's do it this way. Usually, souls that leave this world go to the spiritual world. The spiritual world is called Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden. It's not a garden, it's not Eden. It's a spiritual world. That's just the way that we refer to it. Or it goes to the other extreme, called Gehenna. And Gehenna we think of as a place of fire and who knows what, but it's not like that either. It's a spiritual place. The soul, after it leaves this world, either goes to a place which enhances it because it's been a soul that accomplished what it's supposed to accomplish in this world and is fit for that enhancement, or it's a soul that has blemished itself in this world and needs those blemishes to be corrected. And that's called Gehenna. It's a place of correction for the soul. There are certain souls that are so blemished that they're not ready yet to go into Gehenna meeting. They can't be corrected. Let's give an example. Sometimes you have clothing that are dirty, so you throw them into the washing machine, and the detergent in the washing machine will clean them, and they come out fine. Sometimes the stain is so set that throwing it in the washing machine won't help. So before you throw it in the washing machine, you have to put it into a pre-soak. And you soak it overnight, and then that doesn't take out the stain. But it prepares the stain that now the detergent can take it out. Okay, I don't know if that's really true, but it sounds right. I haven't washed clothes in a long time. In any case, I think that's pretty accurate. So imagine a soul that is stained and blemished, normally can go into the washing machine called Gehenna and be cleansed. But sometimes the soul is so blemished and the blemish is so set that you need first a pre-soak, and then the soul can't even get into the spiritual world. It's so grounded in the physical world that it can't release itself from the physical world completely, and then it goes into what's called kathakela. Kathakela literally means a slingshot. The soul is shot from one end of the world to the other, but it's not really what happens, just a euphemism, that the soul has to go through a period of time, and their time is different than our time. But in our terms, it could be years, it could be thousands of years, it could be days, it could be hours, where the soul is grounded to a certain degree in the physical world, not actually in the physical world, but grounded, can't release itself totally from the physical world. And in that situation, those souls, that's what we call ghosts, can sometimes be seen. Because like we said, the soul can take on a physical appearance. It's not a physical body, but it's the spiritual counterpart of the physical body. And they look, therefore, like bodies. And they can sometimes be clothed in the clothing that they were that were put onto the shrouds when they died, or their regular clothing, or whatever, since it's all just an apparition. So how they appear can change from time to time. But they can be seen sometimes by people whose are more sensitive to the spiritual world, or at times that people are sensitive, or in places where the spiritual and physical world meet and overlap certain ways. So you don't see them all the time, but sometimes there are things that happen. A person is sensitized, or certain kinds of people who are more spiritually inclined, or at certain times or in certain places, things happen that were traumatic, and the physical and spiritual world are more in tune, where these souls can be seen. That is called ghosts, and they're seen whether sometimes in a dream and sometimes awake. And just, I'm going to tell you two or three stories of things that were said by not Stam anybody, but people who are impeccable, right, in not reporting things that didn't happen. Okay? Tell you an interesting story, and I'm not a great storyteller, so I'm going to do it quickly. Going to great ghost stories here. We don't even have a campfire, so it really wouldn't be the same thing. Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld was the chief rabbi of the of Jerusalem at the turn of the 20th century. And he was a well-known rabbi. He was not a storyteller, and he was a very serious person. He relates the following story that he personally was a witness to. The story, the way he describes it from after putting all the information together, there was a woman who she was a wealthy woman. She had a husband who was a wealthy man. And she adopted many souls who didn't have people to say Kaddish for them. And she gave money to institutions to have Kaddish said for these poor lost souls. And then her husband died, and she lost all the money, and she became destitute. And she went to the institutions, and she begged them, please, I can't pay you anymore, but I paid you in the past. Would you please continue saying Kaddish for these poor lost souls? And they agreed. And then she came to a situation. She had two daughters of marriageable age. She had no money to give them a dowry, no way of marrying them off, and she was really, really upset. And all of a sudden, she's walking down the street one day, and an elderly man greets her and says, I realize your plight in life, and I would like to help you. How much money do you think you need to marry off your two daughters? Give him a figure. And he gave her a note, and he said, you go to this and this bank tomorrow, right? Give the note to the president of the bank, and he will give you the money. What's it called? He gave him a check, signed check, and he said, I want to make sure, though, that the president of the bank will not think that you forged this or whatever. I want two witnesses to be here now to witness the fact that I'm signing this check and who I am, and the president of the bank will honor this check, I guarantee you, especially when the witnesses say that they saw it signed. So she sent into the nearest yeshiva for two young boys, teenage boys, to be the witnesses. One was Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld in his youth. This is what he... And the other was Rabbi Yehuda Greenwald, also a very famous rabbi. Both of them in their youth, they were the witnesses. The next day, the woman goes to the bank, and she presents the check to the president of the bank. And he looks at the check and he faints on the spot. And he said to her, "Where did you get this check? It's a forgery." She said, "No, it's not. And I have witnesses that it's not a forgery." He said, "Who gave you this check?" So she started to describe the man. He said, "Look up above my desk. Is that the man who gave you the check?" He said, "Yeah, that's him. That's my father. He's been dead for 20 years. So she said, "But there were witnesses that he signed this check, that man." He called in the two boys, and they said, "Yes, we saw that man sign this check yesterday and give it to the woman." In any case, the president of the bank said, "I'll tell you that I believe you, because last night my father came to me in a dream, and he said, 'Tomorrow somebody's going to bring in a check from me, and I want you to honor it. This woman paid that people should say Kaddish for me because you didn't say Kaddish for me, because you totally abandoned me. And this woman paid that there should be people in the yeshiva saying Kaddish for me, and that kept my soul going. And I want to repay her. So you're going to take the money out of your bank and make sure that she gets paid.'" Now, here there were witnesses, people who were impeccable, that saw this man, an apparition. They didn't see him as an apparition. They saw him as a real person. He came in a dream to his son. So these things happen. They definitely happen. I had a case myself. Nothing spectacular. But I once came home late at night. My youngest daughter, who is now 20, but at the time she was a few months old, and she was crying. And usually, I'm not such a great father or husband, so if my baby was crying, I just waited till my wife got up and went in and took care of her, because I didn't know what to do it anyway, so what difference would it make if I would go in? And I saw my wife wasn't going, and then I heard my wife yell out to me, "Zev, can you get the baby? Get the baby." And it didn't sound like my wife, because my wife spoke a lot different to me than this voice. This voice was really stern. And I went into the room, and thank God I did, because somehow she got caught between the bottom of the crib, right, and out, and her head was stuck between the, not the mattress, but between the holder of the mattress and the crib. And if she had been like that a few more minutes, she would have strangled to death. And mamish, it was a mamish. And then I realized she was named for my grandmother, who had been dead for quite a few years. And the voice I heard was my grandmother's voice. No doubt in my mind. My grandmother told me, "Go get that child." And that was no doubt in my mind that that was what it was. And in fact, later on, I told my wife, "You know, what's it called? It's a good thing you told me to get the baby." So what are you talking about? I've been asleep. I haven't heard the baby cry. There was nobody else in the house. So I'm convinced that that's what happened. So it happens. It happens. There's a maisa with the stipler, who also was not a person who told stories. And the stipler gone reported that somebody came to him and wanted a blessing. And he wrote down his name. And the stipler said, "Do you have a brother in such and such a place in Israel?" He said, "Yeah, how do you know?" He said, "I'll tell you, the strangest thing happened. Last night, right, a person came to me in a dream, a dead person. He was the shamus of a certain shul that I never knew. He told me that your brother used to come and learn in that shul on Fridays, and he used to disturb him by taking care of his tasks that he had to take, and disturbs his learning. And now in the next world they're giving him trouble for wasting this time from this person's learning. So if your brother would go to this person's grave and say that he forgives this Shamus, it'll make his soul much easier to go on to the next level in the next world. The Stipler said, I didn't know this person, he just happened to come to me, right? And it's unbelievable, the night before I had a dream about his brother, same name, and about this Shamus who came to me and told me, and after checking out all the factors, it all was true. It really was. And there are many, many stories like this, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds from all generations. So these things exist. It's possible to communicate with souls. Souls communicate with people. People have had their relatives, fathers, mothers come to them during the Holocaust and tell them to run away or to take this route and not a different route. And these things are documented. So they can't all be hallucinations. And many of them, the factors are so impossible for a person to have just thought up that they are true. Okay, next, let's go to something else now. Okay, so that's one aspect. An aspect of souls who have left this world but still can communicate with people in this world, be seen by people in this world for various reasons. Then there are Gilgulim. Now, Gilgulim is normally explained as reincarnation. But reincarnation is a very difficult idea to swallow, because it seems to imply that people keep coming back in different bodies. And the same people can be different people throughout history, and there are people who can regress you hypnotically and remember previous lives or whatever. We know what's the problem with that? When it comes for the time of the resurrection of the dead, who's going to come back? The person's been here five times in five different bodies, so who's of those five is going to be the one to come back? Now the truth is, that's not such a difficult thing. Because is it going to bother you by the resurrection of the dead which suit of pants or suit or dress you're going to wear? So if the body is only a suit of clothes that the soul wears, that's not you. You're not the body. You are the soul. And the soul just comes back five times and each time wears a different suit of clothing. What difference does it make which suit of clothing comes back in the end? The body is only a suit of clothing. It's you. It's you. What suit of clothing you wore in the 1600s, 1700s, 1800s is irrelevant. Right? If you look at the body like that, if you think you're the body, then it's a problem. Well, which one of us is going to be back? It's all the same. It's just different suits of clothing. But it doesn't work like that anyway. Even if it would be like that, it wouldn't be so difficult, but it's not like that at all. It's not the same person coming back over and over again. Like we said, there are different aspects to every soul. And these aspects, each one by itself, can be a different person, different personality, except they're like a cluster of souls. You have a connection to a group of people that all share the same soul, but not the same soul, different sparks of the same soul. And it's a totally different personality, different person, but there's a connection between these people. Different levels of the soul, different people, but they're all part of the same cluster. And all of them will come back by the resurrection of the dead. Each one will be a separate personality, but they all will be connected and different facets of one cluster of individuals. That's why sometimes you meet somebody and you feel you have a relation, connection to that person, or your lives are very similar. Those are usually soulmates. People from the same cluster of souls. And they don't have to be from the same generation. They can be over spans and spans of time where those souls come into this world different times, and you have a connection to the person who was here 100 years ago. It's not you, but it's part of the cluster of souls that you're connected to. It's another spark of your general soul, and each spark is a personality to itself, is a person to itself with its own free choice, with its own judgment or whatever, but there's a connection between those souls. That's an idea also of reincarnation, but it's not the reincarnation you normally think about. It's the emergence of different aspects of perhaps the same soul, but a soul is more of a cluster of souls than an individual soul. Then there's another idea. And that's a different kind of Gilgul. That's a Gilgal where souls, like we said, sometimes can't get into the washing machine. They can't get into Gehenna. And they are forced to be grounded in the physical world. But sometimes that grounding means that the soul has to be contained within an inanimate object. Goes into a stone. That mean, doesn't mean the stone becomes the person. Or into an animal. Or into a plant. Doesn't mean that the person becomes the horse. Right? The horse is that person. That's not what it means. But the soul is imprisoned in that horse, and it goes through a certain atonement and a certain difficulty that it needs to correct things, blemishes or whatever that happen in this world. So souls can be contained in plants, in animals, in inanimate objects, and even in other people in a very passive way where there's no connection. I don't even know that some soul is imprisoned in me. It has no connection to me at all. It's just that in my body, that soul has to be imprisoned. That's another kind of Gilgal. Then there's a third kind, and that's called a Dibuk. That's made famous by Hollywood and by Yiddish novels, the Dibuk. Dibuk just means to attach. Sometimes the souls that are doomed to remain grounded in the world and can't get into the spiritual world attach themselves. They are hounded by spiritual forces, by angels or whatever, that torment them. It's part of their atonement. If they can go into another human being, a living human being, they can avoid a lot of that torment. And which human beings are vulnerable to be attached by these souls depends on various factors. But sometimes people are possessed. That's called possession. And that does exist. There's a famous maisa with the Chafetz Chaim. No time now to go into details. But the Chafetz Chaim, again, was not a storyteller. And the people who witnessed this were the greatest rabbis of the generation. And a young girl was possessed by the soul of a person who had done terrible, terrible things. And was running away from these angels, and the girl didn't make a blessing when she drank some water, and because of that she was vulnerable to possessed, and the soul refused to leave. And they spoke to this soul from her body, without her mouth moving, without her tongue moving, and got information of what was going on in the world, the spiritual world that this soul was aware of. And finally they promised the soul that they would help to do things in this world that would help it reach atonement, and the soul left through the little pinky. There was all of a sudden like an explosion and a hole in the window, and the soul left. And they were reliable, very, very important rabbis that witnessed all of this. And they used to tell it over year by year on Shushan Pur. The Chafetz Chaim would tell over this thing. Okay. Now, the concept of Gan Eden and Gehenna, what is that? So, basically, the order of the history of the world, okay, we've said we came from a spiritual world. We all come into this physical world, and in this physical world, we earn our share in the spiritual world. We spend time here and accomplish, and what we accomplish, we get for eternity. And we go back to the spiritual world. The Rambam, and here there's an argument between two great rabbis, the Rambam, Maimonides, and the Ramban, Nachmanides, exactly how things are going to play out. Everybody agrees there's a spiritual world before this world. Everybody agrees that there's a physical world here. Everybody agrees there's a spiritual world after this world. The Rambam says that Gan Eden and Gehenna is called the world to come. Not because it isn't here now, it just comes after you die. But it exists parallel to this physical world, and when the souls leave this world, they go into that spiritual world eventually. Like we said, some take longer to get there. Then the Rambam says there'll be a time when the souls will be put back into the body, but only temporarily. That's called the resurrection of the dead. And that time of the resurrection of the dead has a purpose of giving reward to the body. The body also did good things in this world. It also deserves to share in the reward, not just the soul. So the body also will be rewarded. And also many injustices happen in this world because of people's free choice. That will be a time when all the injustices will be rectified. And then the souls will once again leave the body, go back to the spiritual world, that will be eternity. And that is called the world to come, total spiritual world. That is Maimonides. Nachmanides says differently. He says, yes, there is a spiritual world after the physical world, but the resurrection of the dead is what we call the world to come. And when the dead will be resurrected, it won't be the same physical world we know now. It'll be a world to come, a new world, that will be made specially for eternal quasi-physical beings. We won't have to eat or drink or carry on a lot of the bodily functions, but we will have a physical body or a quasi-physical body, and the last stage of history eternally will be souls in some kind of quasi-physical body in a quasi-physical world that will exist forever. That's the difference of opinion between the Rambam and the Ramban, and we'll have to wait to find out what exactly is going to be. Now, bottom line to all of this, okay? Bottom line is that the physical world is important and the spiritual world is important, and they go hand in hand. And God would have left us in the spiritual world and given us that connection to Him, but He wanted us to earn it. He wanted us to create it. And what we do in this physical world is eternally significant, because you can only create and earn your spiritual eternal bliss if you do it in this world. This is the place to do it. The result is in the next world. But the rabbis compare it to a preparation room to a castle. Here's where you prepare, and if you prepare properly, you get into the castle. If you don't prepare properly, then there's no time to prepare after you leave the preparation room. And the whole reason this world was created was as that preparation. So what a person does, and it's not just certain things you can do, it's not just when you're in shul or when you're doing a mitzvah. Everything you do in this world can be done in a way that makes your soul more godly, and then you have a greater relationship to God after 120 years. Or you can do things in a way that makes you less godly, and then you have less of a relationship with God. The world to come is an intimate, close relationship to God, which is the greatest pleasure and bliss that could possibly be eternally. We create it in this world. We don't earn it. We create it. We either make our souls more godly or less godly. We have a Torah that gives us guidelines. What is more godly, what's less godly? But you have to apply it to every action in life, every aspect of life, political, economic, marriage,